Welcome to Teacher Talks at Valdosta State University with your host, Dr. Forrest Parker, brought to you by the Dewar College of Education and Human Services and the Department of Teacher Education at Valdosta State University.
Welcome to another episode of Teacher Talks here at Valdosta State University, a podcast for teachers by teachers. I have my two friends here this time, actually, the Ellises, and Oliver and Vanessa, and they have known me since before I was really a teacher. I knew them both separately, and now together. So it's a love story, an education love story. So in case you can't tell, this podcast is being recorded live in a coffee shop in Columbus, Georgia, where we all met. So we're just gonna, it's gonna be informal conversations. There is no, there's no agenda, except for the right wing agenda. It's gonna be some agenda. So how are you guys, doing?
We're doing great. Thanks for having us on. This is exciting. This is only like my second podcast experience. I believe this is like your first.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
So yeah, we're definitely novices. But yeah, my name is Vanessa Ellis. I'm an eighth grade teacher in Muskogee County. I teach Georgia Studies, which I absolutely love. I'm my county's Teacher of the Year this year, 2022-2023, and I'm also a top 10 finalist for Georgia State Teacher of the Year, so that's really exciting.
And at one point, you were like the top economics Teacher of the Year?
Yeah. They selected two teachers, a high school teacher and a middle school teacher, and that was in 2017. So yeah. I think that distinction honestly kind of set me up for being a finalist for the state. So it's definitely an honor to be in this position and, you know, put Columbus on the map and advocate for my people.
So we heard a little bit about Vanessa. Who the hell are you, Oliver?
I ask myself that question all the time. So my name is Oliver Ellis. I am a science educator over at Rain McCullers School of the Arts. So teaching science at an art school. Which is interesting. Yeah. This is my 13th year in education, maybe. And I'm certified in math and science, and I've taught math and science both at a Title I school as well before I moved to the Fine Arts School. And at that, the Title I school I was at, I was selected a Teacher of the Year. I made it through the local district process to the top three for the school district. And I just enjoy teaching science, using the arts in any and every way I possibly can, which is why teaching in a fine arts school was like the perfect fit for me. So that's what I do now.
So when did you first start teaching? Because I thought I had had like 12 years in, and I thought you had been teaching before I.
So
I was subbing. When
you were subbing with me my second, maybe my third year.
Okay.
Because I was in science, right? Yeah. It was my third year because I'd just come back from, so my first year I did science and she was not there. And then my second year, I taught math, and that's when Vanessa came. And then my third year, I went back to science.
Right.
And I think that's when you were in there with me doing like our ILT or something like that.
Yeah. Reading. Do you want to tell them how we met?
Yeah. Well,
that one night in Paris.
That one night in Paris. Yeah. No, just from what I remember, it was like you came in as a sub for our music teacher. And while you were there, like, they just kind of threw you into my class, and like, you showed up, and I didn't know who you were, and you're like, hey, I'm here to like help, and I was like, huh? But then you and I started reading, and I remember specifically you reading like the story in like the most engaging and creative way, and the kids were just like super enthralled. Like, I remember that very distinctly. And then I also remember going to our principal when she was trying to decide who to hire for that open position, being like, you need to hire this guy. And then she didn't. And I was like, that's the dumbest decision she could have possibly made. But that's how that goes.
Yeah, that's the story of my life. Yeah. The number of times I've been told, hey, I got a job for you. Don't worry. I got you. Is literally insane.
The even better part is that the person she hired was like fired or let go or quit within like 2 or 3 months for like inappropriate behavior with children. Like, either cussing them out or something.
Yeah, maybe
terrible.
I dodged a bullet.
I guess. That's all I remember.
Well, that's kind of what I remember too. And I remember I was subbing, and I really, really wanted to be a teacher. And when Vanessa and I graduated, they were like a hiring freeze. Like,
yes.
They weren't hiring anybody, even if they needed you.
Right.
because of budget cuts and stuff like that, because of the economy. And so I was subbing, and I was just trying to live my best life. And I remember getting put in these horrible situations, like your room. No, I'm just kidding. No, your room was great. But every time I got a chance, I was like, I'm going to teach my ass off, because this is what I want to do, even if I'm a sub.
Yep.
And I remember your room, because it was supposed to be a science room, but you had like a stage in the back with like rock and roll music and stuff like that. And I just remember being like, this guy really knows what the hell he's doing. It looks fun and engaging, even though I was only there during like the extended learning thing that was supposed to happen. So, and so, explain, how did y'all meet? Y'all are teaching at the same school.
You want my version or his version? Because they are not the same.
Oh, okay. Well,
go ahead, Vanessa.
Sounds like yours is
juicier. You lay the truth on him, Vanessa.
My truth. I will say my truth. Okay, so it was his second year teaching at Fort, and it was my first year. And, you know, we're just colleagues or whatever. I remember the first time I met him, he was listening to Vampire Weekend. And, like, I was into alternative music, and so I was like, I didn't know anybody else who listened to that. So that was the first thing I was like, that dude has good taste in music. But then, you know, they just keep teaching, living life. And then we start eating lunch together as a team, and then him and I just kind of slowly like just start talking to each other.
So y'all were
on
the same
lunch.
Team?
Yes, he was my team leader.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Okay, it's not like an official position. Okay, it's not one of those situations.
Yeah,
just let's go ahead and clear the air.
Yeah.
But same team, as in we all teach, you know, the science, math, social studies, and language arts for all the same kids. Yeah. So we had all the same things to talk about and same problems to sort out too. So
we just kind of like, and we were the younger people on our team, so we just kind of gravitated towards each other, and we had a lot of the same interests. So the Hunger Games movie was about to come out, and he was talking about it. He had already read all the books, and I was like, this sounds interesting. So I like buy the book in preparation for the movie. Don't really get that far past it or whatever. So I texted him and was like, I'm going to go see the movie with my cousin. Do you want to come? It was super informal. He swears up and down. It was like me shooting my shot, but it was not. It was literally just, hey, do you want to come hang out with us? And we went to the movies, and you walked me to my car. You're very gentlemanlike. And then it's like from there, we started hanging out more. And I remember the distinct moment where I was like, okay, I think I like this guy. We went out to eat after a play, a kid's play, and it had been raining, and I looked a hot mess. And I remember going to the bathroom and seeing myself in the mirror. I was like, oh, my God. So I'm, like, trying to fix my hair. And the rest is history. We started dating at the same school. We got engaged, got married, had our first child together, all while working at the same school. And then when the fine arts school opened, he went there, and I transferred to veterans.
No.
And our plan is to come back together. Like, what has it been, like 6 years we've been teaching apart? The plan was always to come back together because he's an awesome educator, and like I want to be around other awesome people, you know?
Yeah. So I have a provocative question. So you've won all these awards and done all these great things. Do you think you could have done that at the Title I school? Or because you switched the fancy, so they were at the not fancy school, and now they're both at fancy schools. So I'm wondering, I've always wondered that, like, do you think you could have had the same recognition, the same clout if you had come from?
Yes, because that's where, like, that was the foundation for my success. All while working at Fort, I was teacher of the year at Fort. I was in the top 10. I was able to go to Harvard, which is sponsored by a nonprofit group in Columbus called MEEF, the Muskogee Educational Excellence Foundation. I was the 2017 Georgia Economics Teacher of the Year. I did all of that at Fort. And so when I transferred to veterans, like that momentum kind of carried. And at first I was trying to like not get any more accolades. I was like, I've already done all the things. Like right now I just want to teach.
Yeah.
And so when I was at veterans, they kept nominating me for teacher of the year. And I was like, nope, already did it. And I had no intention of becoming my school's teacher of the year. But then we got a new principal, and he kind of like forced my hand. I know that sounds bad, but he was just like, you're going to be our teacher of the year. And I was like, okay. And from there is kind of where I started to continue that momentum. But it started at the not so fancy school.
And I would say, just to piggyback on that, is that I think it's because she started at that school she was kind of forced to find new creative, inventive ways to be successful. And, you know, that just kind of matured from there. So it's kind of a rough place to start sometimes, a Title I school, if you're not prepared for that kind of a setting. But it will, it's like a trial by fire. When you come out the other side, you're...
I think you just said something that I believe in the deepest parts of my soul. If you can teach, and I've had principals say this, Chris Lindsay at Carver, he's told me, it's like, hey, if you can teach here, you can teach anything.
That's right, I did my student teaching.
Did you really? Yeah. He was my vice principal in high school. But it's so true. Like, if you can learn to be successful in those places, you can teach anywhere. The problem that I see in education is not even that teachers are quitting and, you know, that there's fights. It's really the middle ground. It's the mediocre teaching. Honestly, we're inundated with mediocre teaching, and I see it at the quote-unquote better schools. Like, because you don't have to try, right? You're not going to get a big fight, probably. Mm. You know, the scores are going to be okay, even if you're horrible. They're going to be about the same. So they just get away with, you know, the same classic lecture following this very expensive curricula that the school district buys, and you don't even have to teach. It's idiot-proof. It's teacher in a box, and you follow the curriculum and you do it, and you'll turn out okay if you're in those schools. So I think if you start like y'all did, like we did, you know, in those really rough schools, it shows you, like, you know, if I'm going to be successful and survive, I got to, you know, pull some tricks and, you know, can't just do the same old, same old, same old.
I agree 100%. because it was an interesting transition going from a Title I school to a non-Title I school, and you hit the nail exactly on the head. And so when I went to Veterans, I was like the teacher who did too much, and I was like showing off, and I was like, I'm doing what I normally do to try to engage students who live in abject poverty, students who, you know, are taking care of their siblings, or kids who don't know how to read and don't know how to do basic math. And, like, so I just carry those strategies here. And what happens is, like, those students all don't have those same problems, but they still want to be engaged.
Yeah.
And they still want to enjoy learning. And that's what I did for them. And so, I agree with you 100%.
But to the same point, a lot of teachers who start off in those rough schools quit. Like, it's like if you can survive, you're going to be good. But, if you know.
So that's... goes to my experience, my first year. So I grew up, I'm Canadian originally, and I came down here. My dad was a doctor. So my dad was a doctor. My mom
was a
really
rough childhood.
We had a rather well-off childhood, and I went to private schools and middle school and high school, and then I went to University of Georgia. Anything I wanted to do ever, I got to do. Like, just coming from a background of, you know, having a lot. And so my first teaching job was at a Title I school, and where students have, like, I think, I don't know, 90% of our students or the population were below the poverty line. It's some kind of crazy number like that. And so my first year was a nightmare. I did not understand the kids. They did not understand me. And because I did not understand them or really take the time to understand them, they became resentful. And my classroom was a nightmare. I would... it got so bad, like every day I would actually, I would go to my door at the end of the day, I would lock my door, I'd turn the lights off, and I would lie under my desk and I would just cry.
Holy shit.
Because it was so bad. They used to have meetings in the learning specialist room, which was next to mine, and they stopped holding them there because it was so loud and obnoxious in my classroom, kids just doing whatever, yelling, screaming, fighting. And so, they couldn't even hold meetings next door. And I kind of had nothing. Now, it was horrible the whole year. Me, you know, not knowing the kids or how to teach them. I was teaching them very traditionally, like lecture and video. You know, I mean, there wasn't really anything fun or interesting or engaging. And so the kids were acting out, like, all the time. Now, at the end of the year, we got our test scores back. And my kids had the highest scores they'd had in that school, you know, in like almost like a decade. And so they were like, you're doing great. And I was like, I'm doing great.
This is great.
I didn't feel like it was great. And so I was actually ready to walk out. And the last day of school, I was walking out. And then one of the veteran teachers called me into her room, Miss Sanderson. She's wonderful and amazing. And she pulled me in and she basically talked to me about, you know, why I'm doing it, and telling me basically I'm doing a good job, and that, you know, if I find some ways and strategies to, you know, make those little parts of behavior better, you know, things to do for them, then, you know, the rest will fall in line. Cause she said, you know, you're a good teacher and that, you know, and that shows. So, I just really, you know, I was really ready to go. And then my second year, I came out and kind of went too militaristic. That was the year I went like too much behavior. Like, we're going to be like military, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to do this. So I tried to pick, you know, whatever teacher had the best discipline in my school and try to model and replicate everything she did.
That's
so,
why I didn't believe him when he said he had a horrible first year, because I met the militant Mr. Ellis, mm-hmm. and everything was like perfectly in line, and I was a first year teacher struggling, so I was like, this dude has it all together and I suck.
Oh no, but the kids hated me and they absolutely adored her, but like, I mean, they hated me. And I wanted to do not, actually her first year, she was so impressively good at building relationships that that's probably what sparked me to become an actual good teacher. Was because I wanted to be the kind of teacher she was, loving and caring and everything else, and maybe finding a balance between what I was doing. Because at the end of the year, like I said, I think we were talking about this earlier, but a kid actually broke my windshield to my car at the last day of school in my second year. Because I was so bad. I was just almost like taking things out, you know, like those kind of teachers take out their problems on the kids, and that's kind of where I was. So my third year, which is when I think I met you.
Must be, because I don't remember the first two.
I went to the Ron Clark Academy. I got sent there my second year. Mm-hmm. And when I did, I discovered a whole different way to just view education. Within the first minute of being at the Ron Clark Academy, we got sent there my second year, like I said. Within the first minute, I was crying with tears because the kids were just so genuinely nice. Like, a kid just walked up to me and said, thank you for being a teacher. I mean, like, just looked at me with genuine love and care, and I was like, oh my gosh, and I just melted. And so I was like,
my kids aren't like this at all. They make me cry for other reasons.
They make me cry for other reasons. So yeah, I was like, what are they doing here that's working? Because if you don't know much about the Ron Clark Academy, I would suggest that you check it out, and especially go there if you can, because it changed my life. Just learning a different way to approach and teach the kids and show them love and get that love back in return. And so in my third year, everything changed. What, a stage was made in the back of the classroom. There's all the music and stuff going on, because that's a big part of what Ron Clark does. Tries to bring in things that the kids are interested in and want to do. So I started rapping science songs and doing all kinds of crazy activities in the hallway, like racing in the hallway. We play Simon Says games to learn about the human body, like just anything kind of creative I could do to make things fun and also find ways to learn more about the kids and who they are as people and help them become the best people they can be. So that all changed my third year, but like I said, it was a trial by fire. Like it wasn't like a one day I just like I can do this. It was like I had to go out, I had to find the professional development that could point me in the right direction. I had to be surrounded by teachers like Mrs. Ellis or Miss Lewis at the time, who like could inspire me to like build a better relationship with my kids. I had veteran teachers like Miss Sanderson who like kept me plugging away. Like there has to be a lot of support for teachers in that kind of an environment, but you can grow so much in a tough environment like that in a Title I school.
So I heard you say a lot. I think a lot of people who listen to our podcast are they're student teachers this semester, and they're going into it for real. There's a lot of students who are listening to this who are in the master's program this is their first year of teaching. And I can tell you that they are experiencing your first year situation where it's just total pandemonium. They don't know what to do. What advice do you have for them going into this coming year? It's almost the close of this year. What can they change? What can they do?
But do you want to take this one?
Yeah, and feel free to chime in. So there are a couple of things, like reflecting back on my first year. And one is to find that circle of support. Like if you work on a team, if you can find those veteran teachers. But if you have people that you can confide in for advice, or if you need somebody to shoot ideas off of, like find a circle of support. That's going to make you really feel like you can do this. Another thing is reflection. Like that's a big part of it, because sometimes as a very novice teacher, you're comparing yourself to other people, and you can't do that. Just listening to Oliver's story, like if you look at him now, you wouldn't be able to believe that that's the type of teacher he was his first year. So you can't compare yourself to somebody who's been teaching 12, 15, 20 years. So reflect, and it's almost like any goal that you have. Like, if you want to lose weight, you can't just look at the end goal and say, I want to lose 50 pounds. You have to be content when you lose 1 pound, 2 pounds, or if you weren't able to run 1 minute, now you can run 5 minutes. Like, it's about growth. So if you are taking the time to regularly reflect, like, what was awful day one, now it's day 30, and this much has gotten better, those small steps will encourage you and keep you motivated to say, okay, in the next 15, 30 days, look where I'll be. Mm-hmm. So find your people, find your circle of support, continually reflect. And then third, I would say, try to grow professionally in any way that you can. And that doesn't mean you have to go to, like, quote unquote professional developments, but podcasts, readings, talking with people, observing other teachers in your building, or if you have the chance to observe other teachers in another context, because you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so you have to be willing to say, this is a problem, and this is, I'm going to read, I'm going to do all the things I can to try to get better.
Yeah.
Because that will really help you along your journey.
I like that. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I just wanted to add on to that. So I everything she's saying, 100%, like, that's in every situation, every year, like, always do those things. Professional development, reflect. Reflection's the big one. I used to reflect at the end of every year. But she's on what I enjoyed about that year, what I did well, what I need to improve for the next year, just things to think about for the summer. But she's saying do it on a smaller scale, like a week by week kind of monthly scale. Like, that's an even smarter decision, because the more you reflect, that's where growth and learning happen. But for me, like, when I think about, like, if I had to give advice to someone who was in my situation my first year, right? The things that I picked up specifically from Ron Clark, when you're in a situation where, like, you know, you don't know the kids, they're from, they're like 95% African-American school is the first school I ever taught at. You know, most of the students are in poverty and freedom.
You should probably tell them that you're a white,
like,
male.
I'm a white male, white cis male. So, you know, they have, you know, the students have their own ideas of who I am just by looking at me. Right. They have their own assumptions of me, just like I have my own assumptions of them. And so the first thing you have to do, and this is my suggestion for you, I don't care where you are in the year. If it's a bad year right now, you know, things are going well, I'd stop right now and I'd just do this. I would spend a little time getting to know the kids, and I would suggest that you let them get to know you. One of the first things that my wife and I do every year is, you know, the first couple of days, people are always doing, like, they're reading over the syllabus or some BS like that, or, you know, they're doing, like, you know, get to, you know, like these little icebreaker activities. Like, those are nice, but it's not getting to the point. The point is, you need to know who you have in front of you, and you need to let them know who you are. Because if you spend a little time and getting to know them and sharing stuff about you, like, then you can really form a connection. Like, those relationships are going to be key, because if they know who you are, if they view you as a fellow human being with a family, with loves and interests, you know what I mean? Like, it's harder to be mean to someone who is, you know, who you view as an actual person. And so, you know, just spending a little time getting to build those relationships and getting to really know your students. I think, like, Ron Clark, for example, he has all of his teachers go to the houses of his students and meet their families, because most of the students who go to the Ron Clark Academy come from poverty as well. And so the teachers had to go there and see, like, what is the actual environment that my students are growing up in and living in. And, you know, if you don't know what your students are experiencing, you need to. Like, I think our principal at Fort had us ride a bus around our local neighborhoods a little bit to kind of see where our kids were living. And I thought that was a brilliant idea. I don't think that the teachers in the bus, other than maybe me and my wife, like, really got what we were supposed to out of it. But, like, seeing where your students live and what they go through, you know, like, talking with kids. Like, for example, there was a kid who I really struggled with, who, you know, after finally talking to him in a detention, you know, I mean, he stayed after school with me and we had a detention, we talked. I found out that, you know, he was sleeping on the, you know, the kitchen floor because his mom's, like, boyfriend had come home, his grandmother's, like, brother was there, and they had taken up the couch and, like, the extra bedroom. And so he had, like, nowhere to sleep except, like, on the kitchen floor. And so he had, you know, had a couple of rough days. Like, you don't necessarily know what these kids are going through or experiencing until you, you know, ask and get a little bit into their life. And so I would just suggest to everybody who's struggling, just take some time to stop and go back and just ask and learn about your students and what they're going through. And it'll kind of change your perspective on them. And it will also change their perspective on you. I remember someone once told me something that was that kind of changed my view on education, but he was talking about it as, like, a marketer. He's like, He's like, my job is, as you know, I'm trying to sell you something, right? My job is to convince the person that I like them. Like, how am I best? I'm trying to make sure I'm phrasing this right. Like, my job is not to convince you to like me. Like, my job is not to convince the students to like me. And my job is to convince the students that I like them. Like, because if they believe I like them, then they will do what they can to, like, help me and care about me. It's just you have to convince them that you care about them. And that, for me, starts with getting to know.
Yeah, I've heard before, speaking of, like, a salesman, people aren't going to buy anything from you if they don't like you. If you're like mean, like you're not gonna buy anything from a mean salesperson, right? You're gonna buy something from the person who's nice and showing you, you know, everything about it. So we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we have more for you. And we are back with our two guests, Vanessa and Oliver, who are lovers and and friends. Used to be
a lover friend.
Yeah, that's right. They're all of the above. So we were talking about advice we have, and one thing that stood out to me that we were talking about is just that idea. For some reason, I think beginning teachers feel like you have to stick to the curriculum, you have to like stay on the right day that your curriculum is. But the best advice that I heard, or at least that resonated with me, that Oliver and Vanessa were talking about, is stop in the middle of a lesson. In the middle, if it's not working, stop.
Yeah.
Reflect. And my biggest thing is just to be honest and transparent and authentic with your students. I can't tell you, even as a college professor, my students will say, like, okay, this isn't working, and I don't want to keep doing this, so we're gonna have to change it up. And just be honest with them. And I think that, because it's not a secret, right? Like, if things aren't working, your students are going to be miserable. You're going to be miserable.
Yeah.
So just say, you know, I feel miserable coming into work every day. We got to change something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a break from the work for a minute, and let's just talk.
Yeah.
What kind of activity, like, and you just have an open conversation. It's okay to say that you don't know, and that you can be better, and that we can do this a better way. So I like that idea of feeling like, you know, you're, and my students in undergrad are always like, yeah, but how are we going to get the standards? Don't we have to keep up? And I'm, okay, but they're not going to learn it anyway.
Yep.
So what difference does it make? Like, you talking to a group of students that are, you know, talking to each other, texting on their phones or walking around or whatever, they're not receptive to what you're selling anyway. So you might as well stop, take a break, so that when you come back, it's more.
Yeah, they can think of it as an investment in time. So, like, if you stop, pause, reflect, recoup, get input from them, then you're earning time on the back end, because now you kind of laid that foundation to where more learning can and deeper and more authentic learning, like you were saying, can take place.
So I'm interested in your story, Vanessa. You're from Columbus, is that right?
I've been here since 99, so
okay. 99 to 2000.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, I consider myself from Columbus.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what was your upbringing? Were your parents doctors, and did you go to boarding school or in Canada or wherever Oliver went?
So it's so funny. We could not be more different in regards of how we grew up. So I was actually born in Jamaica. My dad was Jamaican. And then he moved to the United States on a work visa. And he moved to Michigan, and he met my mom. And then his work visa ended, and he went back to Jamaica. And my love-struck mother followed him to Jamaica. They got married, had me. I was born there, and I only lived there for like a year and a half. And then we moved to Sarasota, Florida. And that's where I went to elementary school. And I was homeschooled for like a semester. And I was like, Mom, this is painfully boring. And that wasn't because of necessarily a place of privilege. It was just like my parents were really conservative Christians, and they wanted to like homeschool me in that bout of time. Which I appreciate, but it was not for me. And so the summer of 99, we moved to Columbus. My dad got a new job here, and we were pretty poor. So my parents had 7 children. At any time, like, we were living in either public housing, or maybe like when we got, you know, good financial situation, we might move into a house, but it was like only 3 bedrooms for like 9 people. My dad, who I absolutely loved, he's no longer with us, but like, he had some issues, man. He was like a compulsive gambler. And so like a lot of things fell to my mom, and I'm the oldest of the 7, and I'm the only girl. So like, I grew up seeing everything. And also feeling like I had a lot of the responsibility in my family. I was like the second parent. And
yeah.
so it forced me to grow up fast. And because I'm the oldest and the only girl and I had all these little brothers, like I just took like educating them under my wing. So we would play school and I would help them with their homework. And so it was one of those cliche things, but like I always knew I was going to be a teacher. Like I just knew that. And I was able to communicate with my brothers and teach them. And then in school, if the teachers didn't explain things well, my friends would turn to me and say, hey, can you like break this down? I'm like, I got you. And so it's just one of those things, like I know how to communicate. And so, yeah. And when you grow up in certain circumstances, like I did, it just, it affects people differently. Some people succumb to those same things that they grew up in. Like some of my brothers are in that situation. But for me, it was like a motivator. I was like, hell no. Like
yeah.
I will go to college.
Yeah.
I will make something of myself. I will be in a stable relationship where, you know, I'm not having to do everything because my husband's not pulling his weight. And so it just really propelled me almost to an unhealthy level, because for a long time I was a workaholic and like,
yeah.
and I
yeah.
still am always like, what's next? Like I'm reaching all
yeah.
the time. So I had a different upbringing. And when I taught in at Fort, like I knew those kids, like
yeah.
I was one of those kids.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about relationships, like I was able to make those relationships because I was like, I was you, I
yeah.
grew up in these situations, but here's the thing, like it can end with you. You can be the one who brings about change and goes about things differently. And so my heart was really there with those kids and wanting to change and love on them and be a role model for them. So yeah, completely different in terms of our upbringing, but we have the same taste in music.
So, when Oliver was talking, you mentioned like you saw him in his classroom management and you thought, oh, I need to incorporate some of that. So what was your first year teaching? Was it hard? Your eyes kind of did a thing. So what is it?
My
hard?
First year of teaching was so hard. So like, okay, I have the relationships, right?
Yeah.
But as a first year teacher, that's still not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Like the pedagogy definitely wasn't there. Like I did a lot of lecturing. Like I can tell a story. Like
mm-hmm.
I can sell salt to a snail.
Yeah.
But like that's all I had. And so every day I'm like talking and I'm big and like I would go home with no voice, Trip. Like no voice.
Yeah.
I'm like, and trying to get them quiet. I'm like, class, please be quiet. Like 1, 2, 3, eyes on me. They're ignoring me.
Yeah.
So my strategy was just to talk louder than them.
Right, yeah.
And so I had like no management, no procedures. Even in my mind, I was like, okay, they're in seventh grade. They've had X amount of school. They know what to do. I even said that in my interview. Ms. Coxon was like, you know, how's your classroom management style? I was like, you know, it was very hippy dippy. And she
yeah.
was like, okay.
Yeah.
So it was not good in terms like I was just exhausted. Exhausted.
Yep.
And then Oliver says that the kids hated him. They didn't necessarily hate you. It was just that like compared to me, like my class was fun, but it was also unruly, right? And his class was very structured. And I was like, I think we wanted a balance of what each other had. I learned so much. And he was a great mentor. Like before he was my lover, he was a really great mentor, like helping me, like, cause I would cry or I would like walk out of my classroom to the end of the hall. I was like, I just cannot with them today. And he was the one who really put me on reflecting and, you know, procedures and structure. He's like, if the kids don't do it right, make them do it again.
Yeah.
I was like, I never thought about that. So I learned a lot, but that trial by fire is what has made me such a good teacher. I learned so many lessons that first year.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Vanessa and I don't know if we met there for the first time, but it's like we clicked for some reason that one credit hour classroom management class we had at Columbus State together. Woefully inadequate. I teach the classroom management course at Valdosta, and it's 3 credit hours, thank God.
But
it really needs to be more. I'm trying to get it to where it's at least once a week for almost 3 hours, but in a school. Like, in a school to where we can talk, you know, do stuff in class, but then we're out teaching for a big part of it. My students hate it, but a lot, and they don't even understand it. I can't convince them yet. But teaching procedures. Like, how are you going to teach how to come in the room? And so they'll turn in their first draft. Oh, I want kids to just come in the room and have a seat. No, no, no. Step one.
Yeah.
Where are they coming to you from? Are they lining up in the hallway? Are you greeting every student by the door? Okay, when they come in, who's monitoring them over here? Where do they have breakfast? Like, all of these things. Like, so they have to account for it, and they don't like it. But I'm like, if you aren't thinking through it now, you're not going to.
Yeah.
Like, day one's going to happen. You're going to have a problem immediately. And it's so hard to catch it once it starts.
So, like, yeah, when I was at four, you know, I think you, Vanessa, and another teacher used to call me the Zen master. And
Mr. Bissell.
Because of how I just, how I dealt with discipline. So like you said, it's teaching those behaviors. You cannot come in assuming they're going to know. You have to teach them every little thing you want. So whenever a teacher was having a tough time in the classroom, I would kind of, you know, I'd hear about it and go volunteer, like, hey, can I come observe and offer some feedback and stuff like that. And so, you know, with a new teacher or even a veteran teacher who maybe was at a, you know, less challenging school before, right? I'd show them, like, from the beginning, all right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to take all your kids and we're going to line up out in the hallway. We're going to start from the start of class.
Yeah.
And we're going to go through, right? How should they be? Should they be over here against the wall playing around? Or should they be kind of standing there, you know, quietly talking to each other? Like, you have to teach them, this is what the expectation here is. And like Vanessa said, if they're not doing it right the first time, have them redo it. So I would just, with that teacher, we would just practice having the kids go into class and sit down. And like sit down without throwing their bag or punching their friend or, you know, jumping on their desk. You know what I mean? Like, you have to show them, okay, this is the expectation. We're going to do it again and again and again until you get it right. And I'm not going to get mad. I'm not going to get frustrated.
Right.
I'm just going to say, okay, guys, that's not good enough. You know that's not good enough. You know, we can't conduct class if we're not coming in ready to learn. You know what I mean? And so you come in, you sit down, you get your pencils out, like just building that routine and structure into what they do. And, you know, and kids will buy in, you know, because at the end of the day, they don't want to do the same thing over and over again. But also, if you have that relationship with them, they're more likely to want to do those things for you. So teach the behaviors and make sure they appreciate it.
And for some classes, that may be, like, you're doing those routines, like, a couple of times a week. Like, this is my 12th year in education. I'm the teacher of the year for the district, and I still have classes where, like, every couple of days, I'm like, all right, let's start from scratch. And it's like that sometimes, depending on the makeup of your class, who's in it, how many kids are there. But I'm not afraid to do that, because I know if we're starting class correctly, that sets the foundation for the remaining time in the class. So, yeah, it's at the beginning of the year. It's in the middle of the week. It's after major breaks, like Thanksgiving break, Christmas break, spring break, you know, and you can't let up, because if you do, what happens is you get to April, May, like springtime, and they're wanting to get out for summer, and school becomes chaos. So you have to maintain those procedures and that order until the very last day of school.
My teaching experience is a little different. You know, I subbed for a while, which is the best education I think anybody can have, is substitute teach in a big county. Lots of schools, every single day you'll see everything.
Crazy, yeah.
But I taught at a center for kids with psychological disorders, and so they were coming in with behaviors, but I knew that, right? And so I caught myself saying, all right, let's practice our procedures on the last day of school. Like, I would say it pretty much every day. All right, let's practice our procedures. How are we going to move from the tables to the floor? Like, literally. Like, all right, let's practice our procedures. How are we going to, it's like, Dr. Parker, relieving to, like, we know how to do this. Okay, show me.
Right.
But also, like, when you're teaching the procedures, think about how you would teach content. Like, how would you teach the science lesson? How would you use those strategies? Reward them, right?
Reward them, right.
Motivate them to do it. Make it into a game. Mm-hmm. I would have my students make videos. Like, okay, we're going to make a video for the next class. And just the process of making the good and bad version.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, let's watch this video on how we do it. And for some reason, that works.
Yeah.
It's an evidence-based strategy.
No, I would say, yeah, and having that, because then they compare, like, they like that competitive comparison, like, ooh, I'm going to do, like, the best video and how you do it. Or make it look bad, I'm going to have fun with that.
Exactly,
like, that is so good. And I would say, too, like, you know, as you're doing these things and practicing them, don't take it personally. Like, don't take their behavior personally. We teachers tend to put a lot of stock because other teachers like watch us in the hallway.
Yeah,
so like we're feeling like judged
very
a lot.
Judgy,
you know what I mean? Like don't view it that way. Just view it as these are your children, you know, your students who you care about and you want them to be successful. So, you know, you just got to be patient with them and teach them and know that, you know, different kids learn at different rates. And so sometimes it takes a couple of them longer than the others.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, as we close out this interview, are there any parting words, parting wisdom that you guys have, or anything that we didn't talk about that you guys want to talk about?
Well, I mean, one of the things I noticed you mentioning there was, you know, teachers worry about the standards and teaching the standards, you know. And, you know, I know every school is going to have different principals with different pressures when it comes to scores. But I'll, as a teacher who teaches at a middle/high school, I teach sixth graders and seniors, like, in the same day, like, back-to-back classes. I go from sixth grade group to a 12th grade group. So, in fact, by now, many of my kids are top in sixth grade are now in 11th grade, taking AP class, AP Environmental Science with me, and they had me in Earth Science in sixth grade. And what I'll tell you is, you know, the concern is that if we don't cover it, how are they ever going to know it? And I'll tell you right now that, you know, going from sixth grade to 11th grade, or even 8th grade to 11th grade, when I have them again, they forget most of what you talk about. But they will remember how you made them feel.
Yeah.
And so don't sweat. I know the test scores matter, but, like, if you're teaching well, you know, even if you leave out a couple things, the kids will do well on that test because of what you taught well. But don't do it from the perspective of, I have to cover this or they're not going to be successful. They will be, as long as you make them feel like they have value and that education has a value. Like, that's what you need to impart to them. It's not the content, because they can always look that up on Google.
Yeah.
It's, you know, how they feel about learning.
We're making better people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you've been kicking it with us this long, I sure do appreciate you guys listening. And my parting advice would be, just if you're a student teacher, if you're observing, if this is your first year in the classroom on your own, just thank you for being an educator. Mm-hmm. I know, like, we don't hear it as much, but I'm telling you from the bottom of my heart, we live in a time now where, like, you know, teachers are leaving the classroom at an unprecedented rate. And so if you're in this profession and you're loving on these kids and you're educating them, like, we truly do appreciate it. And you also are in a time now where the relationship with work is changing. And so, like, we are at a juncture where we can change the future of education, right? So, like, if we don't like how things are going, we can advocate for ourselves. We can make those changes. We can talk with our school leadership, our district leadership, state leadership, whatever the case may be, because we have to make a sustainable future for education. So thank you for being part of the solution and part of this work that we're doing. Just thank you. We really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys for joining me. I appreciate
you.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Teacher Talks at Valdosta State University is produced by Ricky Z Social Media and is brought to you by the Newark College of Education and Human Services and the Department of Teacher Education at Valdosta State University.